What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. This episode of Off the Chain is with the one and only Bitcoin Sign Guy. In this conversation, we discuss crypto anarchy, Bitcoin art, privacy, freedom, rule of law, code as free speech, and Bitcoin's macro trends. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I think you will as well. Let me know what you think, and shoot us some tweets afterwards. Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Got our best man on it.
All right, bang, bang, off the chain with a Bitcoin Sign Guy. Sunday, Mother's Day, recording this, going live. What's up, man?
How you doing, bro?
I'm doing all right. Listen, we've got a lot to talk about. First, let's go through your background first, and then we'll get into the Bitcoin Sign story.
Let's do it.
Where are you from?
I am from Connecticut. I'm a Yankee.
Connecticut.
Yep. That's where I get my stupid preppy wardrobe. That's how I had the pink tie and the seersucker jacket. Because I like to, I don't respect the Fed, so I had to wear something absurd.
You stunted on them.
Had to flex a little bit.
All right, so let's just get right to the story, right? So how the hell did you end up sitting behind Janet Yellen at the meeting?
Yeah, so I was working at a free market think tank in Washington at the time, just covering the event. I work for a monetary policy scholar, and I was just there taking notes to report back to him. I had previously worked at a number of hedge funds out in Connecticut, and there I would cover Fed analysis, which basically means that you have to watch hours and hours of video of Federal Reserve and other, you know, global central bankers just speaking incredibly tersely and, you know, listening for the whatever word they might let slip that gives an indication of if they're looking to raise or lower interest rates. That's basically the game.
Yeah, so basically you've got humans who are trying to read, like, another group of humans' cards that they're trying to hold close to their chest. And it's literally could be one word or a phrase that dictates or indicates, oh shit, interest rates are going up or down.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole bunch of ramifications that happen once you decide that.
And it takes on complete second order effects. So in many ways, you know, all economic data that come out, like, you know, new housing starts or, you know, construction data, car production, like all this data, this is the fundamental distortion of central banking. All that data is interpreted through the filter of, well, what does this make the Fed more likely to do?
Yep.
It's like, oh, there's good economic data that should be bullish, but no, it's bearish because it'll be like, oh, they're about to raise rates. Shit, pump the brakes.
How accurate are people in looking at the data and looking at what the Fed or some of the representatives say and actually predicting what they're going to do?
Dude, They go into it so at such a granular level. Like, you have funds like, I think it's Two Sigma. They were, I think, the first to just throw it on deep learning. They use like a neural net and they figure out, like, they just give it to the computer. They're like, the computer can tell what this says. So it's reached truly an absurd level.
All right, so you go to the meeting. You're sitting there.
Go to the meeting, yeah.
Janet Yellen is saying whatever she's saying.
Yeah.
You're sitting behind her. Did you know when you got to the meeting you were going to do it?
No. It was all spur of the moment.
All right, so you're sitting there. Did you pick that seat because you would be like behind her on TV or anything?
No, that seat was just how the chips fall. So the hearings are actually public and anyone can go. Like, seated to my right, I guess, there was actually just a homeless guy who has a bone to pick with the central banking system. So yeah, we bonded.
He was a Bitcoiner for sure.
Yeah, he's a Bitcoiner now. But basically, what I mean is that it's public; anyone can go. And it was really just how the chips fell that I had the seat. No premeditation.
All right, so you got the outfit on, right? And you're kind of making fun of them by wearing this outfit. You end up sitting just randomly behind her.
Yeah.
Can you tell that there's cameras?
Yeah. So from my previous job, I knew that, you know, the camera's on when Janet's talking. So yeah, it was. I thought that I would, because they put the videos up on like their archive. So I thought that I would go there later, take a screenshot, you know, stick it in my pocket and keep
and it'd be
that.
All good.
It would be my tiny little treasure. And I had no idea that anyone would pick it up at all.
All right. So you're sitting there, you've got the legal pad,
yeah,
and you just literally like sketch out buy Bitcoin on it. And then you're, yeah, just like, fuck it. I'm going to do it.
We'll do it live. Got to do it live.
All right. And so, the part that shocks me is not only like, did you come up with this? Did you write it? Did you, you know, have frankly the courage to do it? But you actually placed the sign perfectly. like if you had reached too far, right, it would have been behind her head. If you hadn't gone far enough, there was somebody else's head there. But you got perfect placement, like no practice. How did you do that?
I don't know. It's the finesse of an art student. I actually studied art, which is why I maybe can draw for worth anything.
Listen, it's clearly articulated, right? You knew to turn and go landscape with the paper. All right, so you do it, right? And I remember the day that you did this. So for those that don't know, he held up a sign on a legal pad that said buy Bitcoin in big bold letters right behind Janet Yellen's head while the cameras are rolling as she's discussing, you know, federal policy and all this stuff. Immediately rips through Twitter, right? When did you know that it was going viral?
I had no idea. Okay. Well, I take that back. My phone was dead at the time, so I didn't have Twitter. But after about 30 minutes, I was escorted out of the hearing by one of the parliamentarians for the hearing.
So basically, you do it. You keep sitting there. You don't know what's going on the internet. But eventually, somebody there comes and says, hey, you're yeah, coming with me. I'm assuming you knew, oh, it's probably because I just held up this sign.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But I thought that maybe it was just because she saw it, like saw me do it, or not because she saw some internet reaction.
Yep. And so when you get outside, like, are they trying to arrest you? Are they just pissed off? Or are they actually respectful?
No, I mean, it's Capitol Hill. So they bounce you respectfully. But after that, I left. I went back to the office, and then all my coworkers were saying, "Bro,
yo, you did it!"
I plugged in my phone, and I thought, "Whoa, holy smoke!"
And so I remember when you did it. Then there was a second photo that emerged, and I think it was on Reddit, where you're basically holding up like the buy Bitcoin sign with another sign that's like who you are and a wallet address.
Oh yeah, I mean, I hate to be such a flagrant capitalist about all this, but you know, I gotta stack sats the only way I know how.
All right, so as soon as you see it going viral, what's the reaction that people have in terms of, are the messages you're getting like from friends like, hey, this is cool? Are people like, yo, dude, you're an idiot, why'd you do that?
Oh, so my dad actually works in markets as well, so he is his conversion from no-coinerism is ongoing, but he saw it and he was embarrassed. He was like, yo, I want to crawl under my desk right now. Like, you just torpedoed your, like, career on, like...
on national television, basically. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, he was correct in some sense. I did end up departing my job at the think tank I was working at, but I quickly found another foothold at CEI, and then from there I went on to work at another Bitcoin fund. And
so as you're doing this, right, the internet, I mean, just absolutely exploded when they saw this photo. And the reaction was less, I think, about like you, right? It was just immediately like Bitcoin sign guy. And it was the idea that somebody was able to market this decentralized digital currency in one of the most archaic and 180 degree difference rooms in the entire world, right? Yeah. I mean, they're literally sitting there talking about interest rates and federal monetary policy and all this stuff, and you hold up this sign. And it was just like, to me, the irony of it wasn't planned. It wasn't a well-produced sign, right? It was just like, we got the point across in the most Bitcoin way possible, right?
Well, yeah, it comes from outside. I think that the entire technocratic monetary order is completely blindsided by Bitcoin. And it's almost been unutterable up until just the other day when Brad Sherman said, oh, well, look, actually, we need to pump the brakes on it because it actually might completely disrupt our finely tuned system here.
So, let's talk about Sherman, right? So he's a Democrat from California. Yeah. He's been in office for 22 years.
Yeah.
His largest donors are all financial services companies.
Yes.
One of them is a payment processing company.
You know, I actually have a deep and abiding respect for Brad Sherman because he gets it. He knows that Bitcoin is here and it poses a true and credible threat to the system he sits atop. The people that I have, less love for are, like, I don't know, multi-coiners, people that sort of have, they're the highly progressive and utopian people that think, oh, it'll all work out beautifully. But the Brad Sherman mindset is correct at its core.
Yeah, so as soon as he said this, I saw a bunch of people being like, oh, he doesn't get it. And no, I went the exact opposite.
He gets it.
That's the best part. He actually understands exactly what is going to happen.
Brad Sherman gets it. Augustin Karstens gets it. The people that don't get it are just like, oh, the blockchain, not Bitcoiners. People that think that this tech will be massaged somehow into the existing world order. No, there is a sea change about to happen. And I think if you're a neoliberal listening to this, you should start stacking sandbags.
Well, and part of this is, I think what Brad Sherman, there was a couple of points that he brought up that I thought were really interesting. One was he very explicitly laid out this idea of the U.S. dollar being a weapon on a global scale, right? And I haven't heard very many politicians explicitly say that in a public forum, right? So this idea that, like, the U.S. dollar is a part of the defense of the United States and the offense of the United States, right? So that's one.
Absolutely.
Two is he explicitly stated Bitcoin has advantages over sovereign currencies, right?
Yes.
So it was the first time I heard a publicly elected official admit that. And the third thing was this idea that if you understand how the dollar fits into the global economic system and you understand the potential that Bitcoin has to disrupt that, there's two paths to take. One is to embrace it and one is to ban it.
Yes.
By saying ban it, he's playing right into the hands of Bitcoiners and like the crypto ecosystem, because all that's going to do is it's the best advertisement in the world for what we're talking about.
Absolutely. 100%.
What did you take away from his comment specifically around like the U.S. dollar and weaponizing it as part of this like foreign policy?
Sure. Yeah. The petrodollar is, you know, I think the strongest foreign policy tool that the U.S. government has. So, you know, if we mean decentralization, we mean, you know, the balkanization of large power in the world. You know, devolving power down to its true level, which is, you know, emergent, market-based, and entirely undirected.
Absolutely. All right, before we get into crypto anarchy and we get off this the Bitcoin sign, you have put together a limited edition 21 of these Buy Bitcoin sign. So you have actually recreated the Buy Bitcoin sign on a legal pad. It's in this beautiful case and you're selling them, right?
Yes.
One Bitcoin a piece.
One Bitcoin a pop. You can go to buybitcoin.art to buy them. I actually have not checked since yesterday. I may be sold out, but I kid you not. Somehow there were 21 people that gave me their names. But at any rate, you can go there. There's an order form.
The part that I love about this is, again, one Bitcoin for a piece of history, 21 of them.
Own the meme.
Own the meme.
Own the meme.
And when you and I talked about you doing it, the first thing you said to me was, I got to get more Bitcoin, right?
Once again, got to stack sats. Shout out to Marty Bent and Matt O'Dell for crafting that fine meme.
It's probably one of the best in crypto.
It's really good. It's really slick.
So the other day, I tweeted at them and I was like, "Yo, you guys will never get the kind of recognition that they should for creating that meme." And I said it's one of the best marketing messages. And Matt O'Dell just came in and fucking reverse dunked on me on Twitter and was like, "It's not a marketing message; it's a lifestyle." Like he went between the legs, reverse dunked on me, and I had to just say, "Man, you win that one."
That's sweet. It also I like stack sats because ultimately I think that Satoshis are. It will be the numeraire of Bitcoin itself. I don't think that we want to deal with eight places to the right of the decimal for the rest of our lives. I would much rather use Satoshis or Kilo Satoshis, KSAT.
Yep.
That's my modest proposal. But yeah, stacking sats, fabulous.
So smart. All right, let's get into crypto anarchy. You are a crypto anarchist, I think I can say. Hell does that mean?
I mean, I would like to be. Crypto anarchy means being willing to build things to affect, you know, Bitcoin's revolution.
Okay. So what does that entail?
Building things. Literally just that. If you are making a product that helps people, I guess, adopt Bitcoin, use it more effectively, or if it clears up headaches for them getting out of the legacy system, that's all very well and good. But the emphasis is on entrepreneurship and self-sovereignty, but not in a way where you truly have self-ownership, self-direction.
And so the whole idea here is Bitcoin's going to become the global reserve currency, right? And so there's two things that you can do. You can convert your legacy bad technology fiat currency into the new decentralized digital currency of Bitcoin. So one, just upgrading your assets, right? And then two is there's a whole bunch of infrastructure that needs to get built to make it easier to more securely and safely hold it, transact it, right? Use it in stores, etc. And so it's the idea that if not only are you holding the assets, but also you're going to want to build all that infrastructure, and a crypto anarchist is essentially doing anything possible to help facilitate the building of all of that infrastructure. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. It's, people these days, they hear the word anarchy and their mind skips to nihilism, the old bomb throwing anarchists like a Vanzetti, I think, the Italians, those damn Italians. but it's truly about building things and participating in Bitcoin in a constructive manner.
What are the biggest areas you think right now that people should be focusing on?
Well, I would really say anything that increases Bitcoin's liquidity is probably a fair thing to focus on.
And any examples that you're excited about right now?
So actually I have a startup that is designing a reputation system for Bitcoin over the counter trading. So this is something that can be used perhaps you could call it like a KYC AML workaround, But, you know, as we upgrade our cybernetics, you know, from legacy systems to new systems, you know, we have new ways of doing business, of generating trust, and you know, figuring out how we conduct civil society online. I mean, it really, the old institutions, like policy think tanks in general, like an official like conversation around policy, like this is all outstripped, all outmoded. You have, you know, 20 somethings, you know, coding for Bitcoin Core, having true policy discussions, and it's all litigated in the forum of Twitter and you know, Telegram chat groups. There is no more, you know, official narrative.
Absolutely. And so let's talk a little bit about this idea of liquidity, right? This, you know, really, I think most people, they struggle with the balance in their mind between a store value asset that you should hold, right, versus the need for liquidity. How do you balance that?
I would say that Bitcoin as a store of value has basically been decided effectively by the hard cap. I admire, you know, the Austrian thought that went into that decision by Satoshi. And then when I say liquidity, I really mean something that makes it easier for legacy finance to acquire. So the concern, and of course you working in legacy finance, you could speak to this better than I could, but you want your average portfolio manager to say, oh yeah, you know, I could take a big position in Bitcoin because I could actually take the position without, you know, exposing myself too much.
So basically I can buy it, and when I want to get out of it, I can get out of it, right? There's enough of that liquidity there to go in and out with size, right? Meaning it's not just, sure, hey, let me buy $500 or right, $500,000. I want to actually buy $50 million, yeah, $500 million, yeah, dollars worth of Bitcoin.
Liquidity is really a synonym for economic scaling, essentially.
Absolutely. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the payment processing stuff.
Absolutely.
And Defense Distributed. Just give us kind of an overview of how you got involved in all this.
Sure. So a project that I have a deep respect for is the work of Defense Distributed. If you're not familiar with them, they produce the 3D printable firearm materials. And so they have been battling with the U.S. government over code being free speech, and, you know, essentially linking the Second Amendment inextricably to the First Amendment. So they have a lawsuit against the Attorney General of New Jersey right now. If you're in New Jersey, you cannot essentially speak online because the state has outlawed the distribution of their 3D printable files.
So let me just summarize real quick. Defense Distributed is a gentleman created a computer file that simply is software code. Inside of that software code are plans, right, mm-hmm, to feed to a 3D printer. That 3D printer then can produce a gun, right?
Yes.
And that gun works. It actually can fire a projectile.
The gun works.
And it is made out of plastic, right?
So there's 3D printers, which are additive manufacturing. They build up layers upon layers of plastic or composites that can fuse together. Mm-hmm. And then there's also sort of within the category of digital manufacture, there's subtractive manufacture, which is a CNC machine, which is a spinning bit that mills out material, sort of like a drill press, but still controlled by the same G-code axes that a 3D printer would use. And so these are the basic tools that you can translate code, speech, into a physical object. So the category is called Fizzable. You can go to Pirate Bay, the website, with torrents, and you can go to the Fizzable category. You can do a category search, and you can find all this stuff there.
And so with this, the idea was anyone with a 3D printer could take this computer file and they could create a weapon.
Yes.
Right? Obviously, the second you're talking about weapons, government, law enforcement, et cetera, all get very upset and start paying attention. I think that the defense distributed response is software code is speech.
Yes.
And the difference between taking that code and creating a table versus some other object versus a gun is really it's the same mechanism,
but the gun is, you know, more politically interesting. The real thing here is that, like, just like Bitcoin, the government is essentially shocked that we suddenly have these legal arbitrages, you know. So there's the way that you can make a gun for yourself with these tools is the same principle as the fact that you can be your own bank with Bitcoin. There is nothing holding you back from computer access, and we suddenly have these new ways of transacting in a flat, horizontal, decentralized manner.
And so part of the government's response to this, not only is it just, as you said, politically interesting because it's a weapon, they're worried about things like a plastic gun can actually be brought through a metal detector, right? They're worried about the lack of registration around who owns the guns and their insight into that. Are there other aspects that they're worried about, or are those the two big ones?
I would say, you know, if you utter the word terrorism in the West, it's basically been treated as carte blanche to
yep.
to do whatever you want. You want to tap everyone's phones, just say terrorism. You want to get a 3D body scan of everyone who travels city to city, just say terrorism. I mean, it's absurd. I should try to figure out a way to work it to my advantage. Like, buy Bitcoin.art. If you don't buy my signs, the terrorists.
The part that's really interesting, right, and many people know, I was in the Army for, you know, six and a half years, did a deployment overseas, and the idea of terrorism is normally the act of doing something, not even necessarily to harm people, but it is to scare them or control yes. them with fear.
Right? Terrorism is fundamentally marketing.
Yep. And you know, I always joke with folks and I say that the difference between marketing and propaganda is just which side you're on, right?
Yes.
When you're doing it, you're marketing. When somebody else is doing it and you disagree with the message, that's propaganda.
Yes.
Right?
Always. You know, you'll notice if it's the Obama administration opposes the Russian Vladimir Putin's regime. You know, all these words are coded in a way that constructs an image.
For sure. And so as this is going on, the law enforcement, government agencies, et cetera, obviously are not happy with defense distributed as they're fighting this, right? And I come of the mindset of, like, this is going to get decided in court. You and I sitting here no pining on what's legal, what's not legal. We can have opinions, but the real kind of battle is going to happen in that legal framework, right? But before we got there, there was a whole bunch of stuff done in terms of trying to prevent Defense Distributed from distributing the computer files, from shutting down their payment processors. Like, just yeah. talk about some of the challenges they faced.
Sure. So, I mean, thank you. The main one, and the one that I am personally contending with, is their deplatforming on a number of payment processors. So the payment stack, the card payment stack, is, you know, banks, card network like Visa, payment processors like TSYS, and then you have gateways like authorize.net, and then you have, you know, resellers, which is what I've now become, which are called ISOs. And basically, if any single one of those components in the stack object to what you as a merchant are engaged with, if they get cold feet, you know, they can shut you down. So, you know, there are places that, you know, crypto positive people will find, you know, difficulty, you know, remaining on, like, you know, PayPal, Stripe. You know, it's, you have to be anointed. You have to be a blue checked and or blue check friendly to use these services.
Well, and one of the things that we see, so this isn't just in the case of Defense Distributed, the idea of whether the selling of the computer files is legal or not, or they actually monetize not by selling the open source code, they're selling 3D printing devices, right?
So yeah, they sell a 3D. It's not a 3D printer, actually. It's a desktop CNC machine.
Got it. Okay. So, and as they're doing that, these payment processing companies
are saying
we're not going to process your payments.
Yeah, they have a lot of baby boomers. Baby boomers got money. They pay with credit card. They don't pay with Bitcoin. So, yeah, they need that money. They need that money, and it's a headache for them and their contemporaries. You know, every 5 minutes, like, oh damn, got turned off by PayPal, got turned off by Stripe. However,
and the payment processors have done this with crypto. They've done this with cannabis, right? Yeah. They've done this with Defense Distributed. Like, this is not a new part of the playbook. It's trying to go after the single point of failure, which is if you cannot accept the money, you cannot sell things.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, when you have a decentralized digital currency that has much more sovereignty in terms of Bitcoin, now the playing field shifts a little bit. Right. And they actually can't prevent, whether it's a crypto company, a cannabis company, Defense Distributed, from accepting or participating in the Bitcoin ecosystem.
Yes. So, right? You know, Bitcoin works. Like BTC pay server is stupid easy. But yeah, this legacy stuff is a pain. And so for the time being, while we're still paying with credit cards, someone needs to build a payment processor that is working and willing to, you know, develop specialty underwriting relationships that can at least give people a second chance.
For sure. And so as you've been working on this, is there anything specific that you went into the situation believing or not believing, and now you've changed your opinion?
Interesting. I don't know. I feel like I've been fairly consistent my whole life since, you know, my coming to political consciousness and in about middle of high school.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things to me, you know, as we've talked about this, that's really interesting is Defense Distributed has a couple of components to it, right? So they've got the open source software, which is pretty well understood, pretty well defended at this point in terms of how that's treated, what the copyrights on it are, who can use it, how do they repurpose it, all of that. Then they're selling this desktop CNC machine, right? Mm-hmm. Which is by itself not good or bad. Right, so you can make an argument that somebody's using it for good or bad purposes, but the actual machine,
yeah, it's
just an inanimate object.
It's open hardware, right? And by the way, I must mention that if you want to join Defense Distributed and their legal battles, you can go to ddlegio.com.
How do you spell that?
DDLEGIO, like legionnaires.
Got it. Okay.
DDLegio.com. Become a member of Defense Distributed and support what I think is the defining legal battle of our time right now.
All right. And at the heart of this legal battle is this idea that code is free speech.
Code is free speech. And
talk about that a little bit.
Well, the real thing here is that we have, you know, the Constitution, we have the way this world order has been, we have the foundation of it. And interestingly enough, we view like banking as this huge, heavy, sclerotic system that has no hope of ever changing. Yet somewhere buried in the foundation of all of this, of neoliberalism itself, there is a key, a shard, a splinter that can be used to dismantle the entire thing. So ultimately, it will come down to, well, Bitcoin code speech can't get rid of it, unless we want to, you know, slide into full despotism, which I might, you know, not discount that quite so heavily, given past performance. But we do have an exit door that is sort of baked in.
I always talk about Bitcoin specifically as, especially with institutional investors, say, listen, Bitcoin doesn't necessarily need to replace the U.S. dollar or the fiat system. It is an alternative, right? One is a non-transparent, human-driven, inflationary model that is pretty well understood. Another is a decentralized digital deflationary model that many people are just learning about today, right? And they're alternatives to each other. So you get option A or option B.
Yes.
And you as an individual get to choose whether you'd like to participate in option A or option B.
Choice. Choice. Yep. Choice is key. The point of choice is that when there's choice, there is a market. When there's a market, there's competition. When there's competition, you see human innovation. You see people apply themselves to bring better things. So that's really the point of it. And we should have this at every level, like on the level of nation states. How many countries are there? 216 right now.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something. I hope I didn't get that wrong. But you know, you think that that's really the number of countries we'll have in 50 years? Probably not. I think, you know, practically every European country has, you know, a few independence movements within each one. So we will see greater choice.
And we even see this in the United States. I mean, look, Tim Draper and that whole proposal to take a state and break it up into four or five.
Let's balkanize California. Dude, you should have done it yesterday. It's long overdue. But really, the thing with that is, everyone always says the United States. You got to say these United States. The states never would have signed on to the U.S. Constitution if they believed that they wouldn't be able to leave in the future. And then, you know, we have the Civil War, which the great negative consequence of that, not to apologize for slavery or anything grotesque like that, but we essentially, the mechanism for exit within the country was effectively defeated.
Do you think we'll see one of the 50 states leave the United States of America during our lifetime?
I don't know. I think that we will see, like I said, sovereignty must devolve down to its level, like water finds its level. Right now, things are too top-down, too platonic, fascist, you know, that's
somebody, and I probably can't say who it is, but somebody who's pretty well known in crypto recently was talking to me about this idea of like sovereignty doesn't have to be at the state level, right? Like it could just be you, me, and 20 other people. We just say, hey, we're going to opt out, right? And we want to live a different way under a different kind of set of rules. And I haven't thought enough about it yet, like what the pros and cons of that are, but just the mental model or the break from sovereignty has to be at the country or state level to it actually is just a group of people, I think is really interesting.
Yes, I agree. And while we're on that topic, you know, just like the fetishism of like the collective, democracy itself, I mean, it's it's keeping us held in these, I don't know, constrained systems.
What's your thoughts around this idea of we've talked a lot about like privacy and freedom, personal freedom, but there's a counterbalance of, I don't think it is there's any society in the world, right, either today or historically, that has operated with no rules. Right?
No.
So there's got to be rule of law that the people agree to, but what's the balance?
So rule of law is good. Rule of law has, I think, treated humans well since it was first developed. However, the point is that the way we enforce rules in society, markets, it doesn't always have to be sponsored. It doesn't necessarily need a state sponsor. Like the way you transact at the store, it wasn't designed necessarily by any particular, party. It was just how it happens. So what I'm getting at is we can come up with new rules, new cybernetics. We don't need necessarily to have, legal recourse in the courts, or we now can do atomic swaps. You can have a counterparty that you can transact with, never knowing their name, their telephone number, their address. The cybernetic framework of the world is changing with Bitcoin. It's becoming more automated. In some ways, that's actually really, this is sort of maybe the Andrew Yang take, but that's what's, if I have one reservation about Bitcoin, it's that holding the money was the last thing that we really trusted humans with. We gave it to all these smart bankers on Wall Street, and now suddenly we've taken that and just given it to a faceless computer, a combine of entropy.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting to think through how contrasting the different viewpoints are, and we have this world that I think a lot of people are indoctrinated into. And they just, that's how they grew up, right? They just know that, look, this is how it's always been, this is how it will always be. But when you stop and you think about some of the core components of what we're talking about, right? Simple things like privacy, right? The right for you to not have to give 100% of all of your information up to people that you don't know what they're doing with it.
Sure.
Right? The idea that freedom of choice should be, paramount in multiple facets of our life that it isn't today, right? Or even the idea of why you are forced to trust a private company to determine how you use your money, when you use your money, where you use your money, right? These things are kind of nonsensical when you really start to look underneath just that kind of top layer. What I don't know is, how do you get people who maybe aren't like you and I, who spend the time to really learn about this stuff and develop opinions and work to get to this point, how do you get the mass population to start to see that maybe there's a different way to do things?
Just with, as with politics, it's purely demographic. So the reason why people say are statists is because that's what they're comfortable with. That's what they grew up with. Just like you have family traditions, we have religious traditions. You have things that are passed down, but things do slowly evolve over time. And so as we have rising generations that are fully comfortable, practically using the smartphone from the womb, you get people that understand, oh yeah, money is, it has these properties, it's a technology, but it can be iterated on, it can be improved, it doesn't have to be paper. We can design a way to do it better than it's been done by the technocrats of the past.
Absolutely. You've got really interesting views on Bitcoin, right? I think one has kind of you know, everything from the code is free speech to its role in a much larger story around automation and that. Maybe describe a little bit how you see Bitcoin evolving moving forward, and then also where it fits into some of these larger trends.
Sure. So the automation trend is just that. I mean, I'm not making any predictions about, you know, post-scarcity utopia or anything like that. But we're giving more and more to the computers every day. I mean, take the stock exchange, the New York Stock Exchange. It's basically a ghost town. And, you know, when companies like ring the opening bell, you know, they're looking down on guys who are basically just playing a part, acting.
Yeah, they're literally actors. They're extras.
They're extras, and
it's cute.
It's cute, but you know, you realize that we have all these digital systems that run our lives, and it's not really trusted to humans anymore.
So one of the things that I really use as a talking point with institutional investors is this idea that like humans are going to trust machines more than they trust other humans, right? And I always describe it as you do this today. You get lost in a city you're not from. You ask Google Maps to tell you. You don't ask a stranger on the street. If you have a question, you ask Siri or Google. You don't ask your friend. If you want a music recommendation, you trust Spotify or Apple Music. You don't trust your friend, right? So like we're already seeing this in certain aspects of our lives. But it's always non-financial situations. Now what we're starting to see over the last decade is robo-advisors and some of that stuff, right? But the big one, the big leap is actually we are going to trust an algorithm to make monetary policy decisions more so than we are going to trust humans who go into a room, look at some data, and then make an opinionated decision.
Right.
And yeah. I think that makes people uncomfortable.
It is scary. Though I guess at some level we are already, you know, we've completely jumped, you know, the shark, so to speak. We let dating apps, which I highly condemn, we let those, you know, algorithmically determine who they're going to, you know, show us that we might find a match.
Why are you so against the dating apps?
Because I'm a proponent of call it familiar humanity. I think that we need to return to each other.
And describe this more. Like, what do you mean?
I don't have it really fleshed out, but just to see each other face to face.
Oh, you're saying like basically the idea that most of the conversation and the like quote unquote getting to know you is happening in digital form rather than face to face.
Or not that. I have no objection to say text messaging, but what I'm saying is that if you go on a date with someone that the computer suggests to you, that it's it imports a degree of artificiality to perhaps everything in your life. Maybe everything is an image, a simulacra, and you know. That already describes our consumption habits. Anyway, we consume images. We don't really consume, you know, products themselves. It's very much an image-based society and market.
Is that necessarily bad, if true?
I think it produces psychological dislocation if you are living in hyper-reality.
Are you a simulation believer?
I mean that people like to joke about that a lot. But the point is that say you have a city and you have a map of the city. All right, make that map bigger and bigger and bigger and make that map 3D. Make it so big that it is the entire city, that it covers the entire city. At some point, you're just living in the map. So that's the way that reality as we think of it has really been built. So we have, you know, mental memes that we hold dear, and we cling to them. But in many cases, they distort reality.
I am fond of saying, he who controls the meme controls the message.
That's great, man. Marshall McLuhan would be proud of that. That's like a good synthesis there.
Absolutely. How does Bitcoin fit into this whole larger theme of automation?
I mean, simply automating trust in the purest sense. Like it holds the gold, so to speak. And if blockchain utopians, you know, they want to take it even further. They want everything on the blockchain. They want, you know, automated soft serve. And so it's the point is that it's fine to put our money onto this shared ledger. I mean, that's so that the technologic aspect of it is fine. All I'm saying is don't let it occlude that, you know, we build technology to serve humans.
Yep.
You know, we should not let the techno-capital singularity, you know, stampede upon us, but instead we should acquire, you know, a set of morals from some non-automated, non-digitally generated source. Like, I'm a Christian. My name is actually Christian.
Are you doxing yourself right now?
I'm not. I won't give my last name. But you can put the Bible on the Bitcoin blockchain, but you can't generate, you know, the Bible from a computer.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think happens next with Bitcoin, right? So like so people kind of,
well,
let's just take like a timestamp of where we are at the moment. So we've got a digital currency that is about 10 years old, a little more than 10 years old. It's got about $130 billion of market cap. It just went through its third market cycle of kind of boom and bust. We now are at a point where retail investors are aware of it. There are what I'll call early signs of everyday use case infrastructure being built. We've got a politician who's calling to ban it. We have institutional investors who are getting interested, right? Mm-hmm. Many of them haven't yet done something major, but they're kind of at the gate, if you will.
Sure.
Where do we go from here?
Well, I think Eric Voskel has good thoughts about this. I think, and I hope I don't, you know, crib this too sloppily. I think he describes the honeymoon phase, that it's basically the phase of unawareness from, you know, people that have stake in the monetary, you know, order now. They sort of don't know about Bitcoin, first of all, or they're basically unaware, and they don't actively seek to make the policy decision on Bitcoin. The policy decision being, you know, ban it or love it. So as we get closer to that decision, this is, I guess, the honeymoon period winding down. So yeah, it's about awareness of Bitcoin and appreciation of Bitcoin's radical potential being, you know, fulfilled.
To me, it is, when you really sit and think, there's once in a lifetime type opportunities, right? So if you look at what Elon is doing with trying to bring humanity to another planet, there's not very many people who want to try to do that. Two, have the means to do that. Three, frankly, are crazy enough to do that, right? All this stuff.
Yeah.
He's got a shot, right?
He's got a shot. I personally think that Elon Musk will die on Mars. And I don't mean in a crash landing. I mean, I think the man moves there. I think that, you know, a Martian colony is, you know, fully within humanity's grasp.
I tend to think that there's a higher probability of that happening than many believe, right? But I think Bitcoin, for example, is another, you know, once-in-a-lifetime type opportunity where we are talking about a digital asset replacing money.
It is extremely exciting. You know, I was a dork that was interested in money before Bitcoin. But wow, when you think about like what Bitcoin represents, there's so much potential there.
Mm-hmm. Any last thoughts in terms of what you wish people knew about Bitcoin or things that you think maybe they misunderstand that you want to clarify?
No, yeah. I just buy Bitcoin. I mean, it's a simple thesis.
As this was unplanned, and he inspired me, I made this little sign while we were sitting here.
Dude,
recording.
You got to put the strike through the Bitcoin.
Jesus Christ, the Bitcoin sign guy is critiquing my Bitcoin, my buy Bitcoin sign, and telling me I did it wrong. So that's how my Sunday's going.
Do you even know Bitcoin? Are you even a real Bitcoiner? Dude, yo, Bitcoin never forgets the strike through the P.
This is going to get out of control really fast if we sit here and just talk about Bitcoin.
Oh, yo, but tell them what you're doing.
With what?
The sign?
Oh, the sign?
The group?
Not yet.
Oh, all right.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, dear audience viewers.
We have some plans in the works to continue to drive awareness and education about Bitcoin. This week is...
Forget all that. It is to continue to dance on the graves of central banking.
My favorite tweet recently, one of the Winklevoss twins, I apologize to them, I can't remember if it was Tyler or Cameron, tweeted the other day.
I can, for the life of me, not tell them apart.
Well, it's on Twitter, so I should be able to read their name and remember, but I forget which one said it. But they were like, should we rename Blockchain Week to Bitcoin Week? And I was like, that's the greatest thing I've seen in a long time.
It is Snake Oil Week. It is you.
What's the craziest?
You slime around from it's all greasy.
What's the craziest thing you've seen someone pitch that you're just like, that's the biggest scam of all time?
The biggest scam?
Like not necessarily like scam in the sense of like they're just fraudulently, you know, like stealing from people, but just like something that is being presented as an articulate, intelligent idea, and you're just like, that is complete horseshit.
Well, it's not actually the craziest idea that isn't actually crazy at all is the honest Ponzi idea. And just basically being, upfront. I forget which tokens it was, but some of them said, oh, yeah, we are an honest Ponzi, you know, with transparent like algorithms that determine how the payouts work. But I do like that because this stuff is so easy to code, you can play all these, you know, game theoretic experiments very rapidly, and you can really determine economic behavior. You can basically run Augur is a case study in, betting or
yep.
You know what I'm saying. The ease with which you can design, and chop up the flows with crypto systems is it permits a type of engineering that is very nimble.
Absolutely. Before I wrap up, I always do rapid fire questions. Most important company in Bitcoin.
That's hard to say. That's a real tough one. Defense Distributed.
You might not be wrong with that, right? I mean, look, it will be one of the landmark legal battles for sure, because it has so many ramifications.
Yes.
Right? I think we can agree on that. What one regulation would you change or improve if you could?
I mean, it's tough to say that if there's like one single thing. The system sort of leans on itself. I and like I said before, there are there is legal matter buried in our current system that gives us the opening we need. So,
oh, the opportunity's there.
The opportunity actually already exists. I don't think that we need any legal acts of God to for Bitcoin to make it. I think we're 100% at escape velocity and beyond already.
Absolutely. Strap in. Most controversial thought you have in Bitcoin? The thought that you have that you think most people would disagree with you on?
Well, I don't know if people agree with me on like the fact that or on my thought that Bitcoin, you know, strips us of a small shred of humanity.
It's possible. Most important book you've ever read?
Most important book. Well, the most important book I ever read was the Bible. But this book, this is a fun book, Fanged Noumena by Nick Land. I made the San Francisco Public Library buy this book. So if you really want to strap in on a wild ride, you can go to San Francisco and check that book out after I return it, of course.
How can they get it if you have it?
Yeah, Nick Land, you can read that.
What is this about?
Dude, the techno capital singularity, the acceleration, bro. There's acceleration. Are you accelerating?
On the cover, on the inside of the cover of the book, one of the sentences reads,
No. Read.
Wielding weaponized machine Nikali recombined version. I can't even read this.
I'll read you the beginning of Meltdown. Meltdown, the story goes like this. Earth is captured by a techno-capital singularity as Renaissance rationalization and oceanic navigation lock into commoditization takeoff. Logistically accelerating techno-economic interactivity crumbles social order in auto-sophisticating machine runaway. As markets learn to manufacture intelligence, politics modernizes, upgrades paranoia, and tries to get a grip.
That's in your local San Francisco Public Library. Get at your boys. All right, aliens, what the hell do you think? Real, not real? Have they been here? Dude, do we know what they are?
There are aliens, and they're all children of God.
The aliens are children of God.
We all are.
All right. What is your take in terms of, are we going to ever like contact them, communicate, see them, hang out with them, grab a beer?
Oh, what's that?
Give them some Bitcoin.
What's that? What's the name of that paradox that, oh, if there are...
Fermi.
Fermi, thank you. I think that that's somewhat... I can't tell if that's compelling or not, because I think that we still need to develop better, you know, space microphones, if you will, to listen for these... listen for these messages, if any exist.
There's somebody like somewhere in the world who's like a space microphone developer. If anyone knows about a space microphone developer, please let me know. Tweet me or DM me. I'll definitely bring them on the podcast, and that's a conversation I'd love to have.
Yes.
All right, before we end, you could ask me one question. What you got for me?
Who has been your rabbi for learning how to market Bitcoin so well? I mean, you play the game at such a high level. Everything you say goes viral. How do you do it? What's your secret? Damn it. Tell us now.
So there's two things that I think are really important. One is the things that I do and the tactics that I use are not Bitcoin specific. So you could do this with anything, right? Yes. Bitcoin happens to be like the success of those strategies and tactics on steroids because it's so emotional, yeah. Right? So like that definitely helps. The second thing is, and I tell people this all the time, and people always are like, yeah, that's a stupid thing. But like, it's like, keep it simple, stupid. It's authenticity. It is literally just like transparency and authenticity. So like when I'm excited, you know, I'm excited, right? When like I'm pissed off at somebody, you know I'm pissed off at somebody, right? Yeah. When I believe something, I think it just transparently and authentically comes through that like, yo, this guy may be crazy, but he actually believes this. And so I think that once you get that like foundation of just you have to be willing to say the things that you believe, whether you think people agree with them or not. Like that kind of mind shift or the unlocking into the freedom of being able to just say what you believe, I think is the number one thing that holds most people back. Once you do that, then it's all about tactics and strategies, right? So like, look, I ran some of these growth teams at social networks, so I understand how some of the algorithms work. That definitely helps. Two is, like, I've just tested more than most people. Like, I've just iterated on this over and over and over again. I've tweeted more than most people. I've seen what works, what doesn't work. How do people respond? All this stuff. And so when you're doing that, two things happen. One is you learn what works, and so you just keep doing more of what works. But then two is you're, like, curating your audience, right? And so, like, if I was to go and talk about pretty much anything else other than crypto, my Twitter account would just be dead, right? Like, people would just be like, dude, shut up. Like, start, like, talk, like, do the Bitcoin tweet again, right?
Give the people what they want.
Yeah. But if I talk about Bitcoin or crypto, the things go viral. It's because the people have been promised that content, and that's what they're looking for. And so when I violate that and I go outside of Bitcoin or crypto, very rarely is it successful. Now, there are a couple of things that are tangentially related, right? So, like, things around, like, personal freedom, sovereignty, right? Like, that type of stuff definitely works. And recently, actually, the idea of cannabis has become more and more popular because it is a very similar fight with government and kind of rules and things like that that crypto has. Is being treated very differently, though, right? And the difference is there's millions of people in the United States that are locked up in prisons today because of a plant, right? Whereas with crypto, it is more socially unacceptable or not yet accepted compared to other assets versus cannabis and drugs. We're actually imprisoning people, right? Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of empathy between those two groups in terms of people who believe in Bitcoin and crypto also have an affinity for, we probably shouldn't have millions of people locked up because of a plant in the ground, right? Word. And so, like, yeah. Just understanding what those affinity groups are and how they relate to each other, has been a journey to some degree. But once I've understood that, then I kind of understand, like, here's the boundaries of what people want to hear about and talk about.
Well, folks, you heard it here first from the master. You can now go forth and signal, Max.
Listen, Bitcoin sign guy, absolute legend. Highly, highly, highly recommend you go to buybitcoin.art.
Oh, yeah. 10% of the proceeds will be donated to the Ross Ulbricht and Julian Assange defense funds. And I also donated one to Coin Center.
Oh, awesome.
So, yeah, hop on that. They're selling fast.
I've seen them. I think that they're really, really cool. We actually took a picture with the one yesterday, so I'll post that at some point. But I'm a huge fan. I think that in a fleeting moment, you made one decision that that frankly echoed through the world and really just kind of gave excitement and hope to a lot of people. So on the behalf of everybody, thank you. Thank you for coming and doing this.
Bitcoin's in the room. Bitcoin is in the room.
Buy Bitcoin with the line through the B. All right, man. Thanks so much.
Peace.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.